Noon straight up. Okay. All right. Last time I almost finished this attempt at a recap of Job. I used to, when I lived in England, at 11:30 at night, they would have on Monday nights, they would have a recap of all of the NFL games in the United States of America. So it was at 11:30, and it was Britain trying to explain American football to Her Majesty's subjects. And I finally stopped and forgot about football altogether. It sort of drove me out of any interest in the sport, at least while I was there. But that's sort of what I was doing to Job. A really rapid recap of the arguments. I wasn't even giving you the texts because I wanted to treat it as a sort of a drama, as a play, which really is what the book of Job is. It's a play within a play. And so you kind of have to get the 30,000-foot picture every now and again of a book like that just to pick out the dialogue back and forth and some of the themes that run throughout the script. Job, this is what's really important, and it's going to be important for what we talk about next. Job's experience was not an end in itself. We tend to think, especially when we're going through suffering, okay, maybe I'm alone here, when we're going through suffering, that we're the center of the universe. We may not think that all the time, but especially when we're going through suffering, we do tend to think that it's all about us. What's the deal here? And we become even more selfish and more introspective and so forth. It was really important for Job at this point to be brought out of the circumstances of his own anguish and for God to speak out of the whirlwind. And what happens then is, instead of it being about Job, which is what all of his friends were making it too, instead of it being all about Job, it's now suddenly about God. And that's a very important point for us to remember. Our lives are a play within the larger play of God's story, not the other way around. Thinking here of Hamlet's play within a play. You know, the thing that sort of, where the penny drops, the whole meaning of Hamlet comes together as you're faced with the circumstances of this play within the play. The play within the play, in a very short span of time, recapitulates the whole point of the play, the larger play. That's what's happening here. The larger play from Genesis to Revelation is the triumph of the seed of the woman over the serpent. Satan comes to God and says, "Let me at him. Let me at this witness in the courtroom." And God says, "Okay, I'll let the prosecuting attorney interview one of my witnesses." And he's going to try to twist him around, distort him, mess him up, so that he will become a false witness in the trial. And God proves himself out of all of this. He vindicates himself as the one about whom the true witness is faithfully given. And so that's what it's about. The story is not it's not that God has a role in your life play. You happen to have a role in His eternal plan. There's that great book written by a non-practicing Jewish historian, very terrific, funny book, where he sort of describes American addiction to entertainment. And the book, the title is, it's Neil Gabler, "Life, the Movie Starring Everyone." You know, and there's this idea that everybody is sort of has a bit role in my soap opera about me. And this is not about Job. This even his friends are playing that role. Okay, what is it about Job that we need to fix here? Or what about Job needs to realize that he has a role in God's play, not that God has a role in his. This is God's story, and he gets to be a part of it. We also saw that in the face of God's majestic sovereignty, which Job did not question, and God's justice, which Job did not question, there was nothing but terror in Job's heart until he remembered he had a mediator. And Elihu also underscores this point when he says, it all belongs to us to suffer for the common curse. It's not that God is necessarily targeting Job. The only thing that any of his friends really said that was theologically accurate throughout the whole series of speeches. God doesn't just target people. Because you did this, I'm going to do that. It's part of the common curse. It's being part of the fall. And yet he says, if there be for him an angel, a mediator, one of the thousand, to declare to man what is right for him, and he is merciful to him and says, deliver this one from going down into the pit, I have found a ransom for him. Let his flesh become fresh with youth. Let him return to the days of his youthful vigor. Then man prays to God, and he accepts him. He sees his face with a shout of joy, and he restores to man his righteousness. He sings before men and says, I sinned, and I did what was right, or I perverted what was right, and yet it wasn't repaid to me. Very opposite of what the friends were saying. They'll say, you'll be able to say, once you find this unconfessed sin in your life, you'll be able to bring it out into the open and then showers of blessing. Why, you'll have a new car and a new speedboat and, and you'll live on that island that you wanted to live on for a long time. You know, the sort of TV evangelist perspective on life. No! No, then you'll finally be able to say, I perverted justice. I am the sinner here. I'm the one in the wrong. Even if God isn't punishing me for a specific sin, He has a right to. He has a right to punish me for that and everything else, including the sins I'm not aware of. But he didn't, and now I'm going to testify not to my righteousness anymore, which he had been doing. Patience of Job, forget that. He'd been testifying to his own righteousness. No, now he's going to testify to God's righteousness and his mercy. And you see, that's why I say his justice, his sovereignty, his power, all of that only drove Job to greater despair until he himself said, I know that I have a Redeemer. And what come what may to this body of mine right now, it will rot, it will decay, but in this body and not another, he will stand upon the earth one day, and I will behold him in this body. That's the confidence. That's the confidence that allows him to raise his eyes to heaven again. God finally speaks up and preaches for himself out of the whirlwind when he answers Job, who is this who darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. Wow. I mean, this is not exactly Hallmark get-well card. Now I will question you, and you will answer me. Isn't this great drama? I mean, this is exactly the sort of thing that you're looking for, a great, vigorous story, wondering how this is going to end up. Basically, God is saying, okay, I've allowed you to put me on trial for a long time in this play so far. But now I'm going to step outside of the dock and I'm going to put you on trial. Can you make a pet of me? Or perhaps put me on a leash for your girls? Any hope of subduing me is false. The mere sight of me will overtake you. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has any claim against me that I have to repay? Everything under heaven belongs to me. Wow. Once again, this is another example of cards we're not likely to see at the Christian bookstore for grieving, suffering people. But maybe we should, actually. You know, there is a time for this. This is law that leads us to gospel. To really have a taste of God's majesty and power. Just to shut us up for once. Is not a bad thing. You know, when in Romans 9, Paul gets to the end there, he says, well then, you will say to me, if God chooses one and rejects another, that's unfair. How can God do that? And Paul simply leaves us where we don't want to be left when he says, but who are you, a mere mortal, to answer back to God? Will the thing formed say to he who formed it, why did you make me like this? Or doesn't the potter have the authority over the clay to make of one the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for common use? It's that kind of divine prerogative that God asserts here on the witness stand. After God's defense of himself, Job is left without excuse. God reminded him, as he reminds all of us, that just because Job didn't have all the answers did not mean that there weren't any. Did not mean that there wasn't someone somewhere who did have all the answers. Namely, God. And it's enough that this God, in whom he can now rely, who is not only all-powerful, but all-merciful, through the mediator, Jesus Christ, is one you can trust, even if you don't have all the answers, but he does. Refusing to buy into their works righteousness and their hollow platitudes, Job became an existentialist, preferring no answers to the wrong answers. And that's where a lot of people end up, who say, you know what, I heard all the stuff when I was going through that trial in my life, whatever it was, physical, spiritual, emotional, whatever. And all I got were the platitudes and so forth, and I knew this wasn't for me. And so in a lot of those cases, people just give up on there being any answers instead of saying, I don't have the answers. But it's okay if I don't have all the answers. It's okay if my friends at church don't have all the answers. It's okay even if my pastor and the elders don't have all the answers. Because the bottom line here, folks, is there is no solution offered in the Bible to the problem of evil from a philosophical vantage point. The Bible does not give us a satisfactory, intellectually satisfactory solution to the problem of evil. And people who treat the Bible as if it is that, as if it does give us all of the answers about the problem of evil, end up denying some important aspect of God's revelation about himself and his purpose for history. Well, then why would we be Christians if there's no solution to the problem of evil? No, I said there's no intellectually satisfying solution to the problem of evil. Not that there is no practical or historical solution to the problem of evil. When it comes to the philosophy, God says, I'm a philosopher. Leave me alone. I'm the one who has the wisdom and the knowledge. All the stuff that you need for philosophy. I'm the one who has that. You need simply to have the faith to believe that I am the one, the all-wise and all-powerful and all-good and all-just one who has holds the world in His hands. And you need to believe that because of what I did, God's still talking here, because of what I did with my son on the cross on Good Friday, and how I brought the greatest triumph out of what was apparently to the world the greatest tragedy. On the basis of what I have accomplished, you can no longer put me on trial for evil. I mean, here at the heart of history, at the heart of the universe, here is the moment where you want to talk about injustice. The one who did not deserve the suffering that he got. More than any human being who has ever lived who could say, I don't deserve this. Here he was hanging on the cross, and not because God let bad things happen or because of, but because of you and because of me. We're not exactly in the best position here to bring a case against God in the courtroom. We're the ones who perpetrated the greatest act of injustice in human history. And yet God is the one who brought about the greatest redemption in and through it. And so Job says he can turn now toward God in this situation because he does have a go-between. He does have this advocate. He's able to look outside of his circumstances and place his faith in his mediator. And you see, that's the important thing that comes out of this. We're going to see a very parallel situation next time. But this is what comes out of this story. One of the great results, one of the great outcomes of this drama really is that because it is about God, because it's a play, part of the unfolding plot of what God is doing in human history to provide redemption, a practical solution to the problem of evil. We can look outside of ourselves. We can look outside of our situations. Don't let yourself be drawn into the trap of trying to figure out what in you is the reason for the suffering you're going through. What is it about what you have done that God is paying you back for? Or, trying to figure out what God is teaching me through this experience. Now, the point is to hold on to Christ, to turn your focus outside of yourself and fasten your gaze to the mediator who stands at the Father's right hand, who will stand upon this earth, and whom you will see, not in another body, but in this flesh, raised, no matter how it decays before your very eyes at present. We're in no better position to take God to court, either for our personal trials or those we experience collectively as a people of a certain time and place. Whether we're facing tragedies in our own families, whether we're watching Twin Towers collapse, we're all subject to the common curse, and we're all beneficiaries of the same common grace. Christians and non-Christians are not marked off in this respect. God sends His rain on the just and the unjust alike, and Christians have no more should no more expect good things to happen to them in terms of their ordinary circumstances than occurs with non-Christians. This is a hard thing to swallow. It's a hard pill to swallow. The psalmist said in Psalm 72, this is where my feet almost slipped. When I looked around and I said, what's all this about reaping what you sow? Look at the rich. Look how well their life goes. Look, they're at ease. They're at ease and they don't care about the things of the Lord. They're sleek, they're fat, they seem to be doing just fine. And then look at me. Look at what I'm going through. He says, my feet had almost slipped until I went in the sanctuary. And then it all made sense to me. See, from a heavenly perspective, when he saw the table of showbread, when he saw the candelabra, when he saw the staff, Aaron's budding staff, when he saw everything in the temple that was redolent of the Ark of the Covenant, everything that pointed to God's unfolding plan in redemption, he said, oh, now it makes sense. And that's what was happening to Job. Now he began to see he was a character in God's story. And now things began to make sense. The suffering didn't. The specific reasons for the specific suffering he was going through still were a mystery to him. But now that's beside the point when it had been the focus. Now, the real issue is, in what way am I a part of this unfolding plot, this unfolding drama? And now Job, with a mediator, can finally say, I'll take the witness stand in the defense. Instead of my role in this play being part of the prosecution, I am going to be a friend of the court. I'm going to give true testimony in spite of the extent to which Satan here has tried to rob me of my salvation. I am going to take the witness stand against him and in favor of the God who has allowed all this to happen. Because it's not about me. And that's what I've learned through this. I'm a bit player in the greatest story ever told. Okay, with that, winding up that story of Job, any questions or comments? Anything for discussion for the next 7 minutes? Yes, Al.
Why does God still point his finger at Job rather than somebody else? Just because Job is a righteous man and allows Satan to put Job through all that? Is there any answer for that? Do we know?
Well, there in the first chapter, you have the conversation that sort of sets it all up. And, of course, we don't know any more than what we find there, but in the conversation, you have, God and Satan sort of having just a conversation about how things are going down here with the, they're comparing notes, the two archenemies comparing notes on how things are going with the plan of redemption. And Satan says, how about that guy down there? He's very godly. He's very righteous. And so let's go for a really holy one. Let's see if one of your holy ones, the best of the best, see what he'll do. I know he'll crack as soon as his body falls apart. That's what all these human beings do. And God says, you have a deal. Now he sets out a hedge around Job. You cannot cross any further. But this is what I'm going to allow. And good grief, what he allowed was just horrendous. But it wasn't as much as what Satan wanted. Necessarily, right. Mm-hmm. Yes, right. And there are clear examples of that in the Scriptures. God punishing David for killing Uriah the Hittite. The first thing we have to recognize, I would say, is the difference between periods of redemptive history where you have fresh intrusions of redemption and revelation, where God is directly intervening, not simply directing things providentially as He is in this age, but intervening miraculously to turn redemptive history radically to the left or to the right. And the life of David is clearly one of those instances. God leads David into battle in a way that He doesn't lead any modern nation into battle. God was in the chariot out in front leading David and his armies into battle. So it was a type of the kingdom of heaven, operating not primarily on the basis of providence, but miracle. So my point there is we can't go back to those instances and say, these stories are basically warnings to us that the same thing will happen to us, any more than they are examples of how we ought to have a tank out in front with God, Yahweh, written on the side of it, that sort of we let Him run out in front of our army. That was a unique time and place where God did directly and immediately punish people. It's not that God doesn't directly and immediately punish people today, but God's direct and immediate punishment is being dammed up until the last day. That's how the New Testament treats it. God is damming up that wrath for the last day. So we don't expect it to burst through the walls, the floodgates, before its time. Now, Christian and non-Christian are equally susceptible to getting cancer. You know, it happens. And we live in a fallen world. But on the last day, that doesn't mean that there is no personal punishment for personal sin. It just means that God is right now damming it up, rather than, as in the life of David, intervening in direct circumstances of punishment. Ordinarily, who knows what God does in His own secrets, but that's the ordinary way of God dealing in the world today. Yeah, Charles Spurgeon said we're all born Arminians. We have to be taught to become Calvinists. And it's true. His point is that we, by nature, do not believe that we don't deserve anything but death from God, and that anything good that we receive is entirely because of the goodness in His heart, not because of the goodness in ours. So, our nature is to believe. We can, you know, take great pride in the fact that we have the right theology and so forth. We still, as Reformed Christians, we still gravitate to Adam after the fall. We still gravitate toward thinking, along with the great theologian Julie Andrews, nothing comes from nothing, nothing ever could, so somewhere in my youth or childhood I must have done something good. And then the converse would be true. Get out of yourself. That's what the gospel does. See, it pulls us out of ourselves, and that is what we find trouble with. That's why the law has to be preached every week, and the gospel has to be preached every week. Because we don't really think that that when we look inside, it's all rotten skeletons, and when we look outside, it's all grace and glory. It just has to happen to us every single week. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you look at the debate going on now between the open theists and the anti-open theists over whether God knows the future. And boy, I'll tell you, on both sides of that debate, I wonder, clearly I'm on the traditional view of God side of the debate, but on both sides, I often wonder, scratching my head, is there like a third of the canon that nobody told me about? Because you know a lot more. You have a lot more to talk about than I do as a minister of the Word. And you talk about it so authoritatively, too. And I've never seen passages of the like that might support what you're talking about. I might believe it. I might be inclined to believe what you say, but what's the biblical support for it? Here we just come back to whenever we encounter God's predestination and God's glory, we're brought to a certain point where we have to affirm things that other brothers and sisters say, well, let's just not even talk about it. Well, God talks about it. Here, he has predestined. He has elected. He has decreed all that comes to pass. And yet, we have to beware that we don't speak where God hasn't spoken. And it's interesting that in all of those passages where predestination is discussed, it brings us up to the point of having to affirm it. And then it doesn't resolve it. It just says, get off of God's cloud. This is his deal. Who are you, a mere mortal, to answer back to God? And Job did that, or you find that in Job, and you find that in Romans 9, and then in Romans 11, where all Paul can say is, not isn't this a great theory, I think it went something like that, but rather, who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor, or who has ever given him anything that he should repay him, for of him, and to him, and through him are all things, to whom be the glory forever. It leads to doxology. Philosophy doesn't lead to doxology. And otherwise it does not make sense. See, that is the important point. It's like a resolution in a drama rather than the resolution in a philosophical theory. That's what we're talking about here. God has proved himself in this courtroom drama that has unfolded before us. But that's very different from having a mathematical theorem that gives us an intellectually satisfying, oh, okay, now I know why God allowed evil in the world or what have you. No, I don't know why God let evil into the world. But I do know what happened in history to get rid of evil in the world. And that's good enough. We're five over, so I'm trying to get over my wicked ways and just to show that